visiting couple from OMF, I felt like I received a call from God to leave my job as an insurance broker and to train for overseas service. And so I did leave my job. I headed off to Bible college, where I studied for 3 years. And during that time, I felt that God narrowed my interest to the Middle East. And there were several ways he did that. One way was through meeting up with an Iranian family who were new immigrants to New Zealand and who didn't know much English. But after I left Bible college, I rejoined the workforce for 3 years. And thus ensued a three-year fight with God. And I felt like God was saying, trust me, and go. And I felt like I was on the top of a diving board, really. And that I was, you know, I felt like I was saying to God, it's really, really boring here, but it's also really, really safe, and I'll stay right here, thank you very much. But God was extremely gracious to me. And during that 3 years, he reaffirmed his call on my life. And it got to the point where I knew that I just had to obey. And so I took the plunge, I jumped, and I applied to Middle East Christian Outreach, MECO, who are not a very well-known mission, but they specialize in the Middle East. And so I went off. After that, things happened very suddenly. I applied, and within 3 months, I was in Syria. And I was living initially with a Syrian family. I'm very independent. I left home when I was 16. And so I went from being an independent person to having to live like a Syrian girl. And so I lived with the Syrian family who spoke no English, a multi-generational family. And I had a curfew of 9 o'clock. And Imzahi, the matriarch of the family, wanted to know where I was all the time and what time I would be home. And I registered as a listening student at Damascus University. I was the only foreigner on campus amongst, I think, about 15, 20,000 students. So everybody knew me. And I learnt the language by just being with the people, by living with the family and hanging out with students at the university. And after about 3.5 years in Syria, the Syrian government decided that that had enough of me. And so they declared me persona non grata, so I had to leave Syria. And I went over the border to Lebanon, where I've been for the last 11 years in Lebanon. I live up in the mountains of Lebanon in a very beautiful spot. I teach I work under the auspices of the Lebanese Evangelical Society, and they run schools in Lebanon. So the school that I'm at is a little mountain school. We have about 280 students. And they're all, apart from two students, all from a non-Christian background, from a Muslim background. So we're privileged to be able to have contact with these students and their families. I found it interesting because my nephew in Hamilton goes to a school where there's Bible in schools. And he said that during Bible in schools, half the students in his class leave. They don't take part in Bible in schools. That's in New Zealand. Whereas I teach in a Muslim school in the mountains of Lebanon, and we have chapels every day and Bible periods once a week. So we have enormous freedom in the school. The school's been in the area for about 150 years off and on, and has a good reputation in the area. So we have incredible opportunities with these students, these Muslim students. So I found it hard when I was asked the feelings question, because on one hand, I don't like Islam, the theology of Islam. But when I think of Islam, I think of my students and the people that I know, and they are warm people, and you would have maybe more in common with them than your average Kiwi on the street. They're very much into family values, into this, you know, the strength of family. They'd be disgusted at binge drinking, all of these things. And so you actually here at Manu Real Baptist have more in common with the average Muslim than you realize. But that's an aside, because I really am not here this morning to talk to you about my work in the school, although that has that takes up a lot of my time. But I wanted to share with you this morning a ministry that I'm involved in the weekends and in the holidays with a group of other people. I told you that when I was at Bible college, I met this Iranian couple, Mahina Muhammad, and I wrote in my journal at that time, God, if you want me to go to Iran, then you will make Mahin and Muhammad become Christians. And Mahin and Muhammad didn't become Christians, although I found out just recently that their daughter later did. But also, I became very interested in Iran. I remember when I was at Bible college, my church history paper was on the history of the church in Iran. But when I got to the Middle East, it was impossible really to go to Iran at that time as a single woman. I became absorbed in Arabic culture and Arabic language, and the whole Iranian thing really just disappeared even from my mind. So I found it interesting how God doesn't forget things, even things that we do forget. And he brought that whole Iranian thing back into my life about a year ago. A group of us, for the last 3 years, have gone down to an area in Beirut called the Corniche, which is basically the waterfront. And there we set up in the Muslim part of Beirut, because Beirut is a divided city, really, since the civil war. But in the Muslim part of the Corniche, we set up a book table. And we attach it by some little handles to the car, because you can't put anything on the footpath legally. So we attach this book table to the car. And we have a big sign saying, free New Testament and DVD. And so it was just Arabs. And so we got to know which Arab countries were open. So we knew that if we had a busload of Bahrainis, then they would be very open and want to take stuff. If it was Jordanians, they would like flick us off like the mud under their boot. But Saudis also very closed. Probably a lot of it is fear, can't take the stuff back in. They would seldom take anything. Syrians would take everything. Iraqis, incredibly educated people, the ones that we met, and they would take as much as they could get, the Iraqis. But about a year ago, my friend Johnny, who's a young American guy, part of our team, he noticed that there were Iranians coming to the Corniche. And so he decided, and we thought he was a little crazy at the time, that he would order and he would print in Beirut 10,000 copies of the Gospel of John in Farsi, the Persian, the language of the Iranians. And we thought that was just utterly ridiculous, really, 10,000 copies. But we didn't know, and he didn't know either, that shortly after that was Iranian New Year. And so the Iranians came in huge numbers. It's their holidays. It's like for us, everyone going on holiday for Christmas holidays. And they just came in their thousands. And within 8 weeks, the 10,000 copies of the Gospel of John were gone. So that was an amazing thing. We also we got the Jesus DVD. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It was made in 1979. It's in about 200 different languages. So we got this in Arabic and Farsi, and we put it initially in a plastic cover, and we were giving those out as well. We couldn't keep up. Like, Johnny was sitting up till 3 in the morning making two copies at a time on his little copier. Now we have three machines, and they produce 10 at a time. So now we've got, you know, we're producing 30 at a time, and those machines are constantly busy. And we got these covers printed, like half in English, half in Farsi. We thought we'd make ourselves a little bit more professional. And we got 100,000 of these printed in last August. And we thought that, everyone said that was too much, really, but the more you buy, the better price you get. And so those are all stocked, piled in my bedroom. And I counted up before I came home in June how many of these were left, the empty covers. There were 25,000. So that means between August and June, we gave out 75,000 of these. So they're coming in huge numbers to Lebanon. They were. They've stopped now because of the Syrian situation. But who are these people, these Iranians? They're highly conservative. They're the religious element of the Iranians. Iranians are on a spectrum. Most of them can't stand Islam anymore. But these Iranians are on the very conservative end of the spectrum, because in Iran, if you want to leave the country, it's very difficult to get a visa. But if you have someone in the family who has connections to the government, and thereby you would be religious, or if you have a martyr in the family who died in the Iran-Iraq war, if you have some connection like that, then you can get an exit visa and go on one of these trips. So they're very religious. They go to Syria for 6 days. It's a religious pilgrimage. So these are Shiites. Iranian, you know, Islam is Sunni and Shia. These are the Shia. And they go to Syria to visit the, there's some sites in Damascus that are very important to Shiite Muslims. So they go there for 6 days and they visit these Shiite religious sites. And at the end of their 6 days, they get on a bus at 3 or 4 in the morning. They go across the border into Beirut. And there's a cable car that goes up to a big Mary statue in a church. They go up there. Mary is a very, very important person within Islam. So they go up to this, what they would call a shrine. To this, it's run by the Catholics, but the Iranians go up there and visit it. Then they go and do a bit of retail therapy. Then they visit a mosque, a Shiite mosque. Then they go to Kentucky Fried Chicken. I asked one guy who spoke English and Iranian, I said, how was the Kentucky Fried Chicken? He said, oh, it was miraculously delicious. Then they come out of Kentucky Fried Chicken and they walk along the footpath till they come to these two big rocks in the water. And if you go to Lebanon as a tourist, you basically are obliged to have your photo taken in front of these rocks. So we're very happy that God put them there because it means that we have a place where we can freely offer, we meet them there as they're walking along the footpath or in front of the rocks, and we give them out. Now we have these very beautiful New Testaments, which are kind of faux leather and high quality, and a DVD, and so we meet them there. I'm going to show you a DVD clip. It's just a minute and a half. It'll give you an idea of what happens. The lady in the red in the photo of the team, I'm going to tell you a little story about her. So have a look at her. She's also in the clip. She's got her back to us, and she's talking to the mullahs, the guy with the turban and the flowing robes. So she's on our team. If we could maybe turn the lights up as well.
ای مهربانم، ای مالک روح و جانم، ای که گشتم پر ز فیضت با حضور جاودانم، ای مسیحا ای تو منجی، ای ز تو دل گشت روشن، ز تو قلبم مطهر، ای شفیع زندگی من، ناظر و شاهد بکارت، ای که از لطف و جلالت جان و قلبم شد از آنت، کردی مرا مریدت، ای که در قلبم نمودی آشکار این محبت، کردی تو هستی، ای که شایسته تکریم، منبع فیض و کرامت، قلب و جانم پر ز خود.
They're warned before they leave Iran that they will meet Christian propagandists in Beirut who will offer them materials, and by no means are they to take anything from them. And also coming over from the buses from Damascus, some of the guides who work against us remind them, you're going to meet people down here and they're going to give you stuff. They're going to try and give you stuff. Don't take any. And all that does is make them want to take the stuff even more. At the start, we were giving out just the Gospels of John, and we know the stuff is getting in because after 2 or 3 months of doing this, people would come along and they'd see us, you know, because we obviously, you know, we're not Lebanese and we've got our big, you know, bags of literature, and they would say, Gospel of John? So they obviously had heard about someone who'd received it. Once I was there holding my bag, and so they came along and they went, Jesus Christ? And I went, I wished I could have said in Arabic, no, but I do work for him. They're very, very open. And in the last few months, I've had, I mean, not many of them speak English, but I've had four or five people pull me aside and say, tell me very quickly, how can I become a Christian? So they are extremely open. I did a Farsi course, just a beginner's Farsi course at the Iranian Cultural Center in Beirut. It was, all of the students were Lebanese, and most of them were young men. I think they were with Hezbollah and heading to Iran for military training camps. And the women were also very, very conservative, mostly covered in black sheets. And so it was a little bit like, one of these students is not like the other ones. But it was really fun doing the course with them. And God was really gracious, and they took me into their hearts. Initially, I think the idea was that I was a spy. And so I thought, much better they think I'm a missionary than a spy. And so I gave them copies of the Jesus DVD as well, and they gratefully received those. A few months ago, I was getting out of my car in Hamra Street in downtown Beirut, and I heard two men walking past speaking Farsi. And so I said to them in Farsi, "Are you Iranian?" And they said, "Yes, we are." And I said, "I've got something for you." And so I gave them a New Testament and a DVD, and they were very, very grateful for them. And then it turned out that one of them spoke English. I was actually able to have more of a conversation than here's a New Testament. And I asked them what they were doing. He said they were there for a exhibition of Iranian goods in Beirut. And they said, come and visit us. And so I said that I would. And that afternoon, I went to the Corniche as usual. And for the first time ever, I fell asleep in the car. And so when I woke up on the way home, I thought it was later than I normally leave. And I thought, oh, I'll go to the exhibition. And then when I pulled up, it was exactly 4:00. And the sign outside said opening hours 4 till 10:00. So I got there right on time. I went in. I looked for my newfound friends, and I couldn't find them. But I thought, oh, while I'm here, I'll buy something for a gift for my Iranian friend. Bought some sweets, and I thought I gave him a Gospel of John. And then the guy across the store from him said, "Cheer, what's that?" So I gave him one as well. And then the guy next to him said, "Cheer," and so I gave him one as well. And he said to me, "Ah, you must meet my friend here working at the exhibition." He said, "He's a Muslim, but he wants to become a Christian. Do you want to come and talk to him?" And I said, "Okay." So I followed him off through the exhibition. I thought, I wonder if this is a trap. It's probably not kosher to be giving out New Testaments in an Iranian exhibition. But it was legitimate. His friend didn't speak any English, and my Farsi is limited, to say the least. So we had to work through the interpreter in Arabic, his friend. And I said to him, "Would you like to meet my Iranian friend? I've got an Iranian friend who I haven't told you about yet, but anyway, she's on the team. She's Iranian." And I said, "She can tell you all about Jesus and Farsi." And he said, "Oh, that would be great." So he gave me his phone number. She rang him, and she met up with went on the phone. He said, "Please don't bring that blonde woman with you." He said, "I'm part of the underground political movement." And he said, "If she comes, then they'll notice that something strange, that she's come back." But she said, "Don't worry, I'm old and I'm Iranian, and no one will ever notice me." So she went, and she took him out to the door of the exhibition, and she walked him quickly through Genesis to Revelation. And he said that he'd been to a church in Iran, and he'd gone along because he'd wanted to become a Christian, although he knew little about Christianity. And they hadn't let him in because in Iran you have Christian background churches who are Armenian and Assyrian, non-Farsi speaking, so traditionally Christian. And even if they're Farsi speaking evangelicals, there have been threats against the church there by the administration that if they receive non-Christian background people, in other words, Muslims, into their services, there'll be dire consequences. And it's not an idle threat, because about 10 evangelical pastors, both Christian and Muslim background, have been executed in the last 10 years. So you can understand the fear of the church in receiving a Muslim. He might be a spy, might be working for the regime. You know, you just don't know. And so he had gone along to church, and was unable to become a Christian. So he said to my friend manager, where do I sign? And she said, well, there's nothing really to sign. And she explained to him about what it means to follow Christ. And she prayed with him there at the door of the exhibition to become a follower of Jesus. And I thought, how amazing, really, because it, you know, the Bible says, he who seeks finds. And I thought, here's this guy, Muslim, in Iran, goes to church, can't get in, comes to Beirut, and by this extraordinary set of circumstances whereby I met his friend, if I hadn't fallen asleep, if I hadn't met them in the street anyway, if I hadn't given to that person who gave, you know, all of those things to bring us together to, that he could meet this woman. So really, he who seeks does find. And I said to manager, how can we do follow-up for him? And then we decided that if God could bring him to do all that, he can take care of the follow-up. Manager, the woman that I pointed out to you in the DVD, she's from Iran. She left in her mid-20s, went to England, married the guy that was sitting next to her, a British guy, who wasn't a Christian. They went to Saudi Arabia where he was working. She became a Christian in Saudi Arabia, as you do. And now they're living in Beirut. He works for an insurance company there. So she's not, you know, a missionary, you know, on her papers anyway. And about a year or so ago, she said to her husband, David, oh, she said, I'm so bored here. We've been here for 10 years. You know, they're both 72 at that stage. She said, I think it's time to retire. You know, let's go back to England, enjoy our grandkids and call it a day. And then shortly after that, she was at a church and someone who had the gift of prophecy prophesied over her. And I don't know if it was a he or she said, you're going to become involved in evangelism here in Lebanon. And she thought, that's ridiculous. I don't even speak Arabic. And I've been here 10 years and nothing. I've done, you know, nothing's happened. And they said, and not only that, but your husband is going to be working alongside you. And if you met David, you would think that was impossible as well, because he works in the insurance industry. He's quite, I mean, I used to as well, so, but he's quite sort of ponderous and slow of speech. He's not what you typically think of when you think evangelist. And now, shortly after that, they heard about the Iranians at the Corniche and became part of the team. And now they're 73 and they're thinking, how can we get David to work longer in Beirut so that we can be here and keep doing evangelism? And she's down there engaging the mullahs and having these big theological conversations with groups around her. And it's really amazing. It's such an incredible fulfillment of that prophecy. I thought also it's amazing how God puts people in the right place at the right time if they're really seeking to serve God. If you really want to serve God, you know, he will put you where he wants you, where you can serve him best. 95%, I think, maybe that's a bit, 90% of the people that we offer the literature to will take it. You know, my pastor from Central, Mick knows him, Digby, he came out a year ago, and he just couldn't believe it. Like, unless you have seen it and been part of it, you really can't believe it. These people are, he didn't even see the Iranians, he only saw the Arabs. If he'd seen the Iranians, he would have been even more blown away, but the people are so open, so hungry, so willing to take a gospel and a DVD. The Iranians, I've had to learn how to say in Farsi, slow down, there's enough for everybody. Because sometimes they're just literally grabbing the stuff out of my bag. For a while, we only had the Gospels of John. We'd almost run out of these, the New Testament. So we started to treat them like gold bars. So there was one guy once who was particularly interested. So I said, he spoke English, said, don't tell anyone, but come with me. I've got a couple of these in the car. And he told everyone, and they all came with me. They were literally scrumming for them. They were like scrumming to get these two New Testaments. And I think there's three reasons for it. The first reason is that in Arabic they have a proverb which is "Kul shi balash katir minnu," which means everything that's free, give me more of it. And so that's part of it. Part of it is that it's free. And I mean, but if you put Gospels free in the downtown Manurea, probably people wouldn't take them. But part of it is a Middle Eastern interest in anything that's free. The other thing is that it's forbidden by Iranian in Iran. Obviously not in the Middle East, but in Iran. And as we know, human nature, everything that's forbidden is more desirable. And so that's part of it as well. But it's not the whole reason, because it's forbidden in Saudi Arabia as well, and they don't take them. So the third reason is that Iranians are just really, really hungry. There's just a real spiritual hunger amongst Iranians. They're completely disillusioned with Islam. You know, 75% of Iranians are under the age of 25. 75%, it's a very young country. When the Islamic Revolution came into power, you know, the Islamic regime, they said breed, and they did. And so most Iranians have never lived in anything but an Islamic republic. And they're young people, and they hate it. They absolutely hate it. You know, you can't wear makeup. And it goes through different degrees of how they enforce these things, but there have been times where you can't wear makeup, you know, the sexes can't mix, you can't be seen with, you know, you can't walk along the street with someone who's not an immediate family member, you can't have a normal life. In the lift, you know, in the government buildings, they put in lifts, two lifts, one for men, one for women, because they didn't even want them to share a lift. So, I mean, the people in Iran are sick, heartily sick of this. I've been reading lots of books in the last, you know, while I've been home. In the libraries in New Zealand are great. And I read a secular author last week who predicted that within a decade, there won't be an Iranian in a mosque in Iran. They're totally sick of Islam. One guy I met at the Corniche, when I offered him a New Testament, he said, actually, us Iranians were running away from religion. And I said, yes, that's true. I said, Khomeini did the greatest favor for the church, because actually Iranians are running to Jesus. They're running to the church. And he said, he laughed and he said, yes, that's true. And he took a New Testament to read. So, you know, it's really a God thing. This is the day for Iran, actually. This is the day for Iran. Many people have been praying for this. I have a friend I pray with once a week, and she prays big. She prays for the fall of Islam. But so maybe it won't be permanent. But she prays that Iran will become like Korea, and that once Korea was predominantly Buddhist, and now I don't know if it's predominantly Christian, but very strong Christian country, very prayerful Christians in Korea. And wherever you go in the Middle East, you'll meet Korean missionaries, actually. So we're praying that Iran will become like the sending country of the Middle East, and that wherever you go, you'll find Iranian missionaries. Because if Iran became predominantly Christian, it would change the religious geography of the Middle East, because they support a lot of, you know, that Hezbollah, and they play an important role, the Shiite Iranians. So we're praying that Iran will become a Christian country. One day I was at the Corniche, and Johnny, who's the young guy with the beard, he came, and then a bus pulled up and it didn't stop. I mean, it stopped, but they didn't get off. And so I said to Johnny, you wait here, you're here now, I'll chase the bus. And so I chased the bus, and it pulled up outside a mosque. And I thought, oh, what should I do? And I thought, oh, well, I've come this far. And so I got out and I offered them a New Testament. And then one of the women getting off the bus, she was quite Western in appearance. She didn't have a head covering and she spoke good English. And she went, oh, the New Testament. She said, I've been looking for this book everywhere. I couldn't find it. I wanted to buy it. She said, oh, and she went, the New Testament, everybody. And they all came over and they took a New Testament, and it was, the mosque was on their tour route. But no one went in. I wish I'd had a camera, because they were all standing outside the mosque reading the New Testaments. It was quite amazing. We get these from a ministry that's based in England. They're Iranians, called Elam. And so they provide the New Testaments for us. They must have good fundraising skills, because these cost about £3 or £4 British pounds each, and we've given out 75,000 of them in the last 8 months or so. They're difficult to obtain in Iran. If you want a New Testament in Iran, you can't just go to a bookshop or anything, obviously, because it's forbidden. You have to look on the black market, and if you can find it, it's not easy to find. If you can find it, it costs about $50 US, I understand. And about 1 in 7 Iranians is on $1 a day. So you're looking at about 2 months' wages to buy a New Testament. So it's not an accessible book in the country. So within Lebanon is one of the few ways that Elam have been able to get Bibles into the country. You know, all that fiasco, and it was terrible what that pastor did with burning the Quran. But the Iranian government do that on a regular basis, where the Bible Society sent in a shipment of these and they confiscated and burnt them, and you didn't hear a hoo-ha about that. Not that I'm condoning the other thing. But through Lebanon, with the tourists, is one of the very few ways that they do get in. Some of the bus drivers, some of the guides work for us now, and some of them work against us. Once a guy was, one of the tourists was talking to me about wanting to say something about Muhammad, and I said to the guide, "Can you translate for me into Arabic?" And he said to me, "Don't worry what he says." He said there are hundreds of groups of believers meeting in Tehran, and he got on the bus. I thought that was interesting. I didn't know what I'd never met him before, and then I met him a couple of months later, and I said to him, "So, are you Christian or Muslim?" And he said, "It's not important what's on my identity card." He said, "The important thing is that the Holy Spirit is living in my heart." So I kind of worked out what box he was in. You know, God is doing a remarkable thing in Iran. In the country of Mashhad, in the north, one of the most holy cities in Iran, a very religious city, they now estimate, and you can never know exact numbers, but they say there are at least 200 house churches meeting in that city now. So God is really doing something amazing there. We feel enormously privileged, those of us who are on the team, to do this. Like often, manager, who's now one of my closest friends, my 73-year-old friend, Iranian friend, sometimes we leave the Corniche, we go home, and I say, "This is better than drugs." And we just can't believe our good luck, you know, that we would be able to take part in this. It's just so exciting. Because every time we go down there, you know, the response is overwhelming, and we always go home with a story. So we are privileged people to be involved in this. Now, I was just talking to one of my colleagues, and he said that it's pretty much come to a standstill at the moment because of what's happening in Syria. So, I mean, you have to be certifiably insane to go to Syria at the moment on a pilgrimage. So the ministry will be sort of on hold for a while at the moment, and I'm not sure what's going to happen with it. It'll eventually open up. But when I go back, I'd like to be involved. In Iran, in Lebanon, we have 200,000 domestic workers from overseas. Many of those are from Bangladesh. We have like 45,000 Bangladeshi maids, which is Bangladesh 99% Muslim. So we have that now, the Jesus DVD, in the languages of all of these domestic workers, foreign domestic workers. So maybe we'll try and develop this side of this ministry, reaching out to these 200,000 terribly ill-treated workers in Lebanon. So we will watch the space. We'll see what happens with that. Yeah. I have here, I don't know if you know, but this is the month of Ramadan, so it's very appropriate that you would be talking about Islam today, because if you're an observant Muslim, you would be fasting from sun up till sunset, from water. And if you're a very observant Muslim, you wouldn't even be swallowing your own saliva. And so this is the month of Ramadan. It started on the 1st of August, runs roughly, till the end of August. And I have Elam Ministries, who provide us with the New Testaments, have given it these booklets. So there are 30 days, and it would be good, I mean, if any of you are interested in finding out more, because every day, every page has information about Iran, about the people, the culture, the religion, and then some items to pray for. So if any of you are interested in finding out more and praying into the country of Iran, particularly in this month of Ramadan, you can take one of these booklets, which are out in the foyer. There is also some Miko propaganda there, which you're free to take. And I've noticed since coming back to New Zealand that I'm still a New Zealander, a much more multicultural society than before I left. And I've met lots of Arabs since I've been home. They're much harder to reach in New Zealand than they are in the Middle East. I think when you leave your culture, you hold on to things a little bit more tightly that remind you of home. But you do have a unique opportunity here to reach out to Middle Easterners in your own community. Purubi reminded us that they're lonely people here, some of them. If they're immigrants, they feel very isolated. And Middle Easterners are very hospitable people, so hospitable. So, I mean, I get invited constantly into strangers' homes for meals. And so you have an opportunity here with these people who are lonely and isolated to show them some New Zealand hospitality. If you know, I don't know if you know anyone who's Arabic or Kurdish or Farsi speaking, but I've got quite a few of these DVDs out there, so feel free to take one of these as well if you know anyone from those backgrounds. So I want to thank you very much for having me here this morning. I do a newsletter. It's very, it's about as rare as hen's teeth. But if you would like to get a copy of my newsletter, then you can put your name and address on a page out there as well. Thank you for having me.